Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. It's hard to believe today, but California's 1960 Master Plan for Higher Education established a system of free public higher education. Tuition was free at UC schools, state schools, and community colleges. And then in 1969, Ronald Reagan convinced the state to relax fee restrictions, and since then, fees have continually gone up. In 1982, annual fees at the University of California totaled $1,200. Today, they're almost $13,000 and $23,000 for out-of-state students, and that does not include room and board or books. Budget cuts, dwindling government assistance, room and board, and the cost of books has made it incredibly difficult for families to afford college. According to the College Board and census data, over the past 30 years, average tuition at a public four-year college has risen by more than 250% to about $30,000 a year, while family income has gone up only 16%, and the average student now owes more than $26,000 in debt. So on today's Your Call, we are continuing our Agenda for a New Economy series by taking a look at the underlying reasons for high tuition costs. What explains the rise, and how is this affecting the choices students make about education? Today we're joined by John Thielen, Professor of Educational Policy Studies at the University of Kentucky. He's author of A History of Higher Education. His most recent book is The Rising Costs of Higher Education, and John Thielen joins us from his office in Lexington, Kentucky. Hi, John. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. I'm very honored to be with you.
Well, we're honored to have you. We're also joined by Melanie Corrigan. She's Senior Director of Higher Education and Financial Aid Policy at the College Board, an organization that connects students and families with education. Hi, Melanie. Welcome to the show.
Hi. How are you?
Good. Nice to have you. So, John, I want to start off with you. We've seen a lot of media coverage on the skyrocketing cost of getting a college degree, and NPR's Claudio Sanchez recently reported that in Arizona, parents have seen a 77% increase in costs. In Georgia, 75%. California, 30%. You know, it's really hard to pinpoint for the average person about why this is happening, but you wrote a book about this. So what do you how do you explain the underlying reasons for these high costs?
I think with all public universities, there's a gravitation toward the mean where students and their families as consumers are expected to absorb a greater part of the cost. But you noted in your introduction about the wonderful 1960 California Master Plan. But I'm going to dissent mildly that I don't think in 1960 or today, charging zero tuition to go to the University of California is necessarily very sound policy. So that ultimately there had to be some increase from that. Another concern I have is in all the data that have been cited, they're using percentages without ordinal numbers, which is very, very dangerous because a percentage goes up very high if your base tuition was quite low. So that's just a mild concern.
So what numbers should we point to? Because, you know, in 1985, if you went to a UC school, the fees for the year were about $1,200, and today that's about $13,000. It doesn't include room and board, which is really expensive, or the cost of books. So what fees do you think we should look at?
Well, I would do some comparisons, for example, with what an institution, a state or university, charges to out-of-state students. I also would keep an eye on what tuitions are being charged by independent colleges and universities in your adjacent or surrounding areas and states. And then you get a fuller range of what it really costs to educate an undergraduate for a year, and then you can start to parse how might we lower that cost in terms of the price that we charge to various students.
Okay, because when you're talking about private schools, I mean, you can go to $40,000, $50,000 just for the fees.
Yes, and I think that you cited that if an out-of-state student were to go to, let's say, University of California, or in Michigan, if an out-of-state student were to go to the University of Michigan, they're looking very, very much like the tuition and fees that we would charge at a very good independent college or university.
Right.
But at some point, there is an actual cost. And then the question that's going to be, I think, most important to families and prospective students is, what is the ultimate price? We often use price and cost as synonymous, and so that's why we would look at student financial aid and other sources to get the price lower, regardless of what the cost is.
And Melanie, you work directly with students and families. What do you tell them when they, I'm sure a lot of them express shock when they look at how much it costs to go to school now, but what do you tell them about the rising costs?
Well, a number of things. I mean, I certainly want to echo what Dr. Thielen said in terms of, you know, there's a wide variety of numbers that you should look at, and I know that it can often feel overwhelming, but it's important to recognize that there's more than 48 or 4,700 degree-granting institutions in the United States. We tend to focus on a very small subset in that, but it's very important for students and families to consider a wide variety of types of institutions and decide what is the best fit for them, and that fit includes academically, geographically, and financially. But certainly, the state appropriations story is the story for the public institutions. A couple of the states that you mentioned, Arizona being one of them, if you look at a recent report out of the State Higher Education SHEO, Executive Officers Organization, Arizona in the last 5 years has seen a 37% decline in their educational appropriations per student. Georgia, you also mentioned, down 28% in just 5 years. And so, you know, these states are having to absorb significant cuts in their funding, and unfortunately that often means shifting some of that to students and families.
So would you say that budget cuts are the main reason why tuition is going up?
Certainly at the public institutions, that is the single largest factor in terms of what is happening for rising tuitions.
And so do we see any end in sight here? I mean, what do the trends tell us about where we're going?
We're seeing some moderation in the decline. I'm not sure that's great news. Of course, you know, 5 years ago, we were in the midst of a significant recession, and we would see a lot of contraction in terms of public appropriations. But so we might see some mitigation of that, but I don't know anyone who expects that we'll see any big boom time in higher education in the near future.
John, what are your thoughts about where this is going? Will tuition just continue to increase?
Melanie made an interesting point about the state of Georgia. And if you wanted to, if you go back more than 5 years, Georgia was had this windfall of the Hope scholarships. And one reason that their percentage decline is so great is the demise of Hope scholarships. But if you go back 5 to 10 years, the University of Georgia and residents of the state and high school seniors benefited immensely from that. And University of Georgia's entering freshman class was looking more like Vanderbilt or Tulane. It was a very high-achieving and also a very prosperous group. And so they had some very good years there. So it's not completely surprising in their case that they get some decline in that. I do think that parental and student concern about the rate and actual cost or price of higher education, I think that is a legitimate concern. And if state economies are down, it's hard to completely fault a legislature or a governor for tapering subsidies for public higher education. But I do think you will not ever find a return to the widespread taxpayer support and gubernatorial support, for example, that California enjoyed at the time of the 1960 master plan. I think higher education has, for better or worse, become something of a mature industry that I think that taxpayers have tended to become entitled and a bit complacent about it. And that is going to be a very difficult re-education program.
That is John Thielen, professor of educational policy studies at the University of Kentucky and author of A History of Higher Education and the Rising Costs of Higher Education. Melanie Corrigan is senior director of higher education and financial aid policy at the College Board. And today we are talking about the rising costs of going to a public university. And we'd love to hear from you. How does or did cost affect the choices you made about education? And if you work at a school, what changes are you you've seen? What are you hearing from students? If you have a child, what are you thinking about this in terms of how you're going to pay to afford college? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And now I would like to welcome a student from George Mason University who's taking some time out of her class to give us a call. Yara Mawafi is a student at George Mason University, and she is founder of a student meal assistance fund. The Washington Post recently had a story called "More College Students Battle Hunger as Education and Living Costs Rise." It's about students who cannot afford food because tuition fees are so high. Hi, Yara. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, it's great to have you. So I understand that you got involved, you tried a couple of years ago to start a program that would redistribute unused meals from the student plans to students who were hungry, but the university told you they didn't have the budget for it.
Exactly. So the initial plan was to donate from 7 to 25% of those unused meal plans. And for changes in the contract with the dining contractor, it just wasn't able to go through efficiently. And we weren't able to have that self-generating way of creating those funds to help those students. So a couple years later, we came up with the fund idea, which is donation-based. And then we provide vouchers to the hungry or homeless students that we have on campus to make sure that they're not compromising, you know, getting food and going to class, et cetera.
It was kind of a shocking article to read where some kids say they don't eat for a couple days at a time because the cost of books and tuition is so high. What are you seeing at George Mason University?
I mean, the two students that were interviewed were from Mason, and we're finding that it's a much larger population than expected. Just last year on FAFSA, 60,000 students indicated that they were homeless. And those are the legally homeless students. And, you know, there's a whole other population of socially homeless, you know, the students that kicked out of homes or are international students, undocumented students. So there's a huge rise in this marginalized population that really just can't afford to eat on a daily basis, just so they can attend their classes and buy those books.
What is the tuition at George Mason University?
As a public university, it's around $5,000 a semester for an in-state student. It's about $20,000 for an international student. So it varies drastically. And that's just tuition, not board and rooming.
Right. And what does board and rooming tend to cost? Or board and books, I should say.
Well, that definitely ranges. It goes from anywhere from $2,000 to $4,000 a semester based on, you know, apartment, loft, dorm room, et cetera. But what we're finding is that these students can't afford to stay at these dorms and can't afford to buy their books. So they're couch surfing. They're sleeping in their cars. They're sleeping in facilities on campus like the auditorium or concert hall, showering in the gym. So they're using the resources that are available to them. But I think as a university, as, you know, a society, we can do so much more for them.
There's a Facebook page called GMU Confessions, and an 18-year-old student with three part-time jobs said, "I have a five-meal-per-week plan, and I'm, like, really, really hungry all the time." Melanie, what are your thoughts on this, and is this something that you're hearing around the country?
I mean, I think we're hearing more about it. I think it's, you know, the point is well taken that it's reflective of what we're seeing at society writ large. I mean, we're seeing students who are coming to our campuses trying to make ends meet across a wide variety of expenses and demands on their time and money. And unfortunately, they're making decisions around their food and everything else to try to make it work. And this is, you know, oftentimes we see students, and the Washington Post article referred to this, who opt to move off campus, hoping that that will allow them perhaps to save a little bit of money, but then often find that the additional expenses of that and then, you know, sort of without the regular meal plan, that they are finding that they are not covering their food costs. And that, you know, is certainly something of concern, particularly as we see more and more low-income and first-generation students entering college and seeing it as an opportunity, as propelling them to more economic security. We're acutely aware of it and concerned about it.
And John, are you hearing anything like this at your school, the University of Kentucky?
About 20% of our undergraduates are on Pell Grants, which is usually a pretty good proxy that a student is from a modest income family. And I think that's relatively high among state flagship universities nationwide. But what I would like to comment is I so appreciated the interview with Yawa in the Washington Post article, and it was a real revelation to me. And what I'm hoping is that benefit of this really frightening news is it does bring attention. And also, I think as this problem of affordability and lack of food, for example, as it moves throughout the whole expanse of the student body, for example, so that it is a problem facing middle-income students as well as, let's say, very low-income students, I think the benefit of that will be that it suggests that this is not a passing, transient, small item, but indeed a significant issue for institutions and policies to face. And that might be the genesis of some genuine correction.
Yara, what are your thoughts on that?
My thoughts, because I'm willing to pay more taxes. So I'll lead by example. And also, one thing that I would like to see is that institutions, colleges and universities, to give more emphasis to need-based financial aid, even if it means cutting merit-based scholarships. I'm a strong believer that affordability is of highest concern, so I would like to see those aid dollars going to students with genuine financial needs.
Yeah, and we'll talk about that a little later in the show. But Yara, you wanted to jump in? Go ahead.
Yeah, definitely want to piggyback off of what John is saying, is that we really need to redistribute the money we're giving out. I mean, we're giving huge scholarships to athletes and, you know, merit-based scholarships. And we have this population of students who are just struggling on a day-to-day basis to pay a couple hundred dollars for books and meals. And parts of our budgets can really cover those costs easily. We're just not doing it. We're focusing on the wrong things. As a university, I mean. And we're finding that the budget to cover expenses for these students is really not that large at all. It's just that there's no initiative. There's no federal national movement to help those marginalized students, whether international, undocumented, or simply from a low-income community.
And Yara, can you give us some stories about the students that you know who are struggling to make ends meet? I mean, especially the students who are struggling to have enough to eat every week. How is that affecting their ability to study?
It's fascinating when it goes from abstract to real cases and real people. And I have, for example, a number of master's degree students who are from very, very modest income family backgrounds, and they never complain. But I know that they are cutting corners. They are working at coffee shops as baristas or whatever, like from midnight to 7 in the morning. And I do not take this situation lightly. I think it is pervasive. A dilemma is, let's say, for example, with a shift to George Mason University, my impression is that, in general, Northern Virginia is a relatively prosperous area and where most of the students are drawn from. So I think what you're going to find is that these incredible ranges and differences within a student body, and so often the public imagery of college students comes from like the promos on the halftime of basketball games or football games, and all I see are very happy, affluent, prosperous students, and I'm pleased to see that image is being balanced with a more complete and realistic view of the kinds of problems that our late adolescents are facing.
Yara?
I don't want to say most favorite, but definitely a striking quote that I held on to throughout this whole process is, I was homeless for 3 of the 7 years I attended George Mason University. I mean, that is so striking to me. A student was homeless for 3 of 7 years. He was a part-time student, which took double the amount to graduate, 7 years. He was homeless for three because he was working up to five jobs just to make enough to, you know, for living expenses, for books, for meals, et cetera. And we're finding similar circumstances with other students. We're finding students that actually live with their parents, but their parents have, you know, several kids that are also going through college, just can't afford to give them the money for food or the money for books. They just pay a little bit of the tuition. We're finding students who are leaving the home for, you know, abusive reasons or circumstances, and are then find themselves homeless, alone, legally bound to their parents because they're still dependents of their parents. So they're not allowed to apply for federal aid as an independent. So then there's also those non-traditional homeless students. We're finding quite the array of different backgrounds and circumstances. Lots of couch surfers, students who really don't believe that they're in need and refuse to really accept those challenges and facts of life and are socializing with their friends and other close ones to really overcome that.
And Yara, is this getting the attention of administrators at George Mason University? I mean, what are they doing about this?
Well, the administration is well aware of the situation. I mean, I've made it very clear to them. I petitioned in the last couple years. I've gained over 4,000 signatures from the student body as well as faculty and staff to raise awareness about this issue. And the first major step we did was the Student Meal Assistance Fund, which, again, just provides meal vouchers to students in need. Now, it's not a sustainable way of dealing with the problem. They're just meal tickets, but it's definitely a start. Hopefully our next phase, which is what we're starting in the next couple weeks, is establishing a scholarship for non-traditional students. So those are the students that don't qualify for state funds or federal funds for whatever circumstances, but will be able to, you know, showcase their story in an essay form and be able to apply to the scholarship that will help them out with electricity bills or gas for their car to get to work, very medical help, medical assistance, very small things like that.
Yara, you're a senior at George Mason University. Did you ever think that you'd be doing this in addition to getting your degree?
Not at all. This actually started out being a project for a speech class I took my freshman year, and a part of the assignment was to do something practical, and that was the petition aspect. And students were so amazed by the information that I was sharing that I thought that I should share it with all of the university.
And I know you have to go in a couple seconds, but what's next for you? What are you doing after you graduate?
I'm actually continuing at Mason. I'm in a dual program, so I'm doing my master's at the same time. The next phase is to actually do full research on marginalized students at public universities, because currently there's no data on these students.
Well, good for you. We'd love to have you back on the show to find out about your research. Thank you
so much for bringing me in.
Well, thank you for joining us, and thanks for the great work you're doing. That's Yara Mowafi. She's a senior at George Mason University and founder of the Student Meal Assistance Fund there. You can find out about the work she's doing and just about how students are struggling to make ends meet to buy enough food for the week. The Washington Post had a great piece, and you can find it at yourcallradio.org. We'll continue with our conversation about the cost of higher education after this.
There are many ways you can join in today's conversation on Your Call with Rose Aguilar, on the phone or by sending an email. The email address is feedback@yourcallradio.org. feedback@yourcallradio.org. The telephone number, toll-free, 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. Coming up in 30 minutes at 11 o'clock, from the BBC, it's World Have Your Say, and following that at noon, John Perry and Ken Taylor with this week's presentation of Philosophy Talk.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will have a conversation about the next generation of farmers. As so many farmers are getting ready to retire, where will the next generation come from, and will they have land to farm? As urban development pushes outward, where will we find the land to feed a growing population? That is tomorrow. And then on Thursday, we will have author and journalist Barbara Ehrenreich in studio to talk about her new book, Living with a Wild God. It is a skeptic's journey. She traces her mystical side. Interesting book from Barbara Ehrenreich. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today on Your Call, we are continuing our Agenda for a New Economy series by taking a look at the underlying reasons for high tuition costs. When you look at the fees specifically, in 1982, fees at the University of California were around $1,200. Today, they're $13,000 and $23,000 for out-of-state students. The average student spends about $1,200 a year on textbooks and supplies alone. A lot of families are struggling to afford college because the fees are now so high. So we're talking about why this is happening, and we'd love to hear from you. How have the rise in fees affected your decision to go to school, or if you have kids, to send your kids to college? How concerned are you about this, and what questions do you have about the rising cost of tuition? Also, if you work in higher education, what changes have you seen over the years? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. And if you have a personal story to share about how you afforded college, we'd love to hear from you, or struggle to afford college, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we're joined by John Thielen, professor of educational policy studies at the University of Kentucky. His most recent book is The Rising Costs of Higher Education. Melanie Corrigan is senior director of higher education and financial aid policy at the College Board. And we had a caller, Brenda, who couldn't stand the line. She wanted you both to talk about administrators' costs and how the budgets for administration are bloated. John, do you think the budget for administrators is bloated?
There's certainly a substantial increase. I think some of the increased expenses are warranted and justifiable. At the same time, I think there is substantial administrative bloat. Heaven forbid, we have some vice presidents at my university who almost make as much as an assistant football coach. That's how bad things have gotten. But the dilemma is that even if you substantially reduce, for example, administrative costs or whatever, I think that's a start, but I think in some ways that's more symbolic than substantive, and I think it would be good to do. But I think that at the state universities, the funding shortfalls are going to go deeper than that, so that ultimately they're going to have to deal with what are potential sources of revenue even after you have trimmed the waste.
And Melanie, what would you say about administrators and the rising salaries of administration?
Well, certainly, John's right. We've seen a significant growth in that, but I also agree that that's really not where you'll see significant changes or savings, in terms of the price and cost crisis. But we've also, when I say we've seen growth in administrators and administrator salaries, we've also just seen a real change over the last decade or two in terms of what those administrators are doing. We certainly have a lot more mental health staff on campuses, computer and IT services on campuses, academic advising on campuses. I mean, a lot of this is also to support growing demands for different and needs for different services at our universities. So I also don't want to leave the impression that this is growth for growth's sake. It really is growth to meet a lot of the changing needs and demands on our campuses.
All right. Well, thank you for calling in, Brenda. Let's go next to Mark in Kensington. Hi, Mark. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. So I am recently unemployed. Before becoming unemployed, my daughter, with my encouragement, applied to quite a few schools in and out of state. She didn't get into any UCs. This week we're making our wrenching decision on, her wish to go to University of Oregon, which is now a total cost of attendance, I think, is how, you know, the better consideration for this conversation is $45,000 a year. She got into some other out-of-states and privates that would be a minimum of 35, you know, in that range, 35 to 50. Mm. So I don't know, you know, what we're going to do here, but one, and also I have a nephew who just finished chiropractic school this past weekend, graduated, living in his truck for much of the past 7 years as an undergrad and then in chiropractic school.
Wow.
Owes $300,000. I think the thing I want to bring up is, you know, the benefits of education are not just for the individual, but for society. I had on this on my little list about ending merit scholarships and just having need scholarships, because merit scholarships often support the wealthy. But finally, what about a tax deduction for families making a certain amount of money that, you know, because of the importance of education for society in general, not just, again, for the individual?
Well, you bring up a lot of points, Mark. And has your daughter applied for financial aid?
Yes, and we literally drove up to Oregon last week to do a last visit, and I came out just like punched in the stomach with the response from the University of Oregon. Sorry, you made too much, which wasn't a lot last year, but it was you know an average middle class salary, and you know. And what she said, this is really interesting, what she said was, even if you had made something like $25,000 to $50,000 a year, you would be able to get a Pell Grant, which would amount to just, I may have this wrong, but I think she said about $5,000 a year. Hmm. I mean, it really puts anybody that is not middle class, it puts almost everybody out of the game.
Well, thank you for calling. John, I wanted to ask you about a ProPublica piece that came out recently, and it found that public universities are increasingly mimicking private colleges by using financial aid to further their own goals, such as enrolling students who will bring revenue or boost their spots in the ranking. And a ProPublica analysis of data from the Department of Education shows that from 1996 through 2012, public colleges and universities gave a declining portion of grants to students in the lowest quartile of family income. The trend has continued even though the recession has hit those in lower income brackets. So the title of the piece is Public Universities Ramp Up Aid for the Wealthy, Leaving the Poor Behind. What are your thoughts on this, and why is this happening?
All colleges and universities, whether public or private, are in competition for talent, particularly academic talent and otherwise. So they will understandably gravitate to try to attract and retain they think are the very, very best students. Now, let me go back Mr. Sherman and Peabody's Wayback Machine to the campus of University of California in the mid-1960s. There you had zero tuition charge. But if you look at the profiles of the student body there, whether in photographs or other data, you're going to see a very affluent, homogenous student body. So my point is that a low tuition charge by itself does not guarantee diversity or access across the socioeconomic spectrum. I think the dilemma with particularly the flagship state universities is they see themselves as very much competing with Stanford, with the Ivy League, with Amherst, with Williams, with Occidental, with Pomona. So there's a phenomenon that an economist named Charles Klotfelder identified some years back, and he called buying the best. And that is part of the sweepstakes of prestigious higher education, and that's both our strength and weakness in American culture.
Do you think that's just because of the makeup of the country back then? I mean, for example, in California, you know, whites are going to be the minority soon, if not now, really. And so don't you think that if school were free today, we would see a completely different picture of the students going to school?
Well, but, you know, with the ethnic and racial changes in the profile, what that does not necessarily speak to is socioeconomic or income. It may well be that with the diversity of, let's say, the UC student body, it still may gravitate toward a more affluent group, if for no other reason than the fact that we know that access to academic resources and AP programs tend to accrue to a more educated, affluent families. I think what you find is that may diffuse into non-white groups, but it does not necessarily deal with the problem of low-income students gaining equity in their access. So that is our kind of partial gain in meritocracy.
And Melanie, what are you hearing from low-income families? How are they grappling with the cost of college and just, you know, the decisions that they have to make based on how much it's costing?
Well, we're certainly hearing it across the economic spectrum, not just from low income, but certainly more acutely at the low and moderate income families, not unlike the situation that Mark described. I think, you know, really they are becoming aware that the federal grant program, the Pell Grant program that was referred to, really will only provide for about the lowest 25% of undergraduates around $6,000. You know, really, we think of financing higher education as past earnings, hopefully some savings, current earnings, what you can pay out of your current earnings, and future earnings, which of course is the increasing reliance on borrowing. And, you know, that is obviously an increasing conversation, a conversation that's getting louder around concerns of student debt. The truth of the matter is the average undergraduate is graduating with around $25,000, $26,000 worth of debt. Which, you know, comes in a 10-year repayment is about $300 a month. Seems, you know, a good investment for a lifetime of education. But we are increasingly hearing the outlier stories, the 3 or 4% of borrowers who do have more than $100,000 in debt. And so there's a tremendous risk there. I think these are decisions that families have to be very realistic about. And again, I, you know, go back to the idea that you have to find an institution that fits you academically, socially, and financially. And sometimes those are just really hard conversations for families.
And on student debt, we have an email from Faye who says, my $80,000 student loan debt is now $180,000 because the student loan interest continues to accrue during hardship deferments. She writes, our politicians are quick to say America must be educated to compete on the world stage, yet our system indentures students so heavily they will not be able to get ahead, let alone buy their own homes. Think of all the income that would be freed up to bolster the national economy if the banks didn't write the student loan laws. A person going into debt to get educated betters our nation more than someone merely buying a house for themselves. Where is the equal protection under the law? All we get is lip service. Well, thank you for the email, Faye, and you can write us at feedback@yourcallradio.org or give us a call, 866-798-8255. We're joined today by Melanie Corrigan, Senior Director of Higher Education and Financial Aid Policy at the College Board. John Thielen is Professor of Educational Policy Studies at the University of Kentucky. His most recent book is The Rising Costs of Higher Education. And let's go next to Julie in San Francisco. Hi, Julie. Welcome to the show.
Hi there, Rose. Yeah, I was a reentry student in my mid-20s. I had tried going to school initially in New York City at City College of New York and for various reasons didn't continue. And then when I tried to figure out how to go back to school, I was stymied by them asking for my parents' financial information. But I had actually left home when I was 15 years old and had been totally self-supporting ever since. But those were the rules, and it was so frustrating. However, I was able, and I thought this might be helpful to other people who might find themselves in a similar situation, to contact my high school and my counselor there who knew that I was living on my own. Hmm. And she wrote a letter, which for which I'm forever grateful. And the school accepted that. Hmm. And I was able to apply for, you know, financial aid that I wouldn't have been able to obtain otherwise. Hmm. So I would recommend that if people are in those circumstances, to, you know, sort of amass kind of a dossier of you know, their life, which is probably easier to do in this day and age than it was when I was doing this in the 80s. And so, you know, keep track and let the truth of your situation be, you know, known and verified as much as possible.
Well, thank you for calling in. Melanie, do you know if there are any programs for people like Julie today?
Well, first I want to applaud Julie for being, I love the term, reentry student, you know, because so many students, so many young people often don't return. So congrats to her for putting in the hard work to get back into college. You know, there are a lot of institutions. I mean, so many students now, I mean, really the traditional 18 to 22-year-old on-campus undergraduate is a minority on our campuses now. The vast majority of students at our community colleges and many of our public four-year institutions are returning students or late-entry students. And so, and they do come with a number of special circumstances. And so my advice is always to talk to the aid administrator, talk to the counselors on campus. It's wonderful that she got back in touch with her high school counselor, if that was able to help. Our financial aid system is sort of devised to deal with the many, and so oftentimes it can be confounding to the special circumstances. But financial aid administrators do have some limited authority to make changes to the financial aid calculations based on special circumstances. It's often hard for students to communicate that. They often are feel embarrassed or just aren't, you know, open to sort of sharing some of the private details of their lives. I'm thinking back around Mark's comment about losing his job. Those kinds of things are often what drive students back to college, and aid administrators are accustomed to hearing that and understand that sometimes those circumstances need some special adjustments. And so she did exactly the right thing, and I, you know, always encourage folks who have those types of circumstances to be comfortable with them and to be able to share them with the institutions that they're applying to.
All right. Well, thank you for calling in, Julie. And let's go next to Wanda in Berkeley. Hi, Wanda. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I wanted to just say that I think the public really needs to follow up when we vote in a tax like Proposition 30, which we voted for and passed, and that was supposed to be a huge boon to the higher education. And I just heard a program on KPFA. It was an expose about that, and that none of that money has gone to higher education. Mm-hmm. And I think that it's really important the public follows up when we vote in a tax. And this is often what is happening, is that there are interests who are able to get our tax dollars. And I'm not sure how they do it, but it's you know, government colluding with corporate and private foundations and things like that. So that's just my, I would say that this is, if we're going to be talking about taxes, we really need to follow up on where they actually go.
All right, thank you. And that was the initiative that raised income taxes on people who made higher incomes and then the sales tax on the rest of us. But yeah, maybe we'll take a look at Prop 30 and get an update on that. So thank you for calling in. Oh, there's also a website, Track Prop 30, that you can check out. Thanks for calling, Wanda. Let's go to Ken in San Francisco. Hi, Ken. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. I'd like to know what percentage of the aid student gets is grants that they don't have to pay back versus loans that they do. And to follow up on what the other caller said, I mean, in my case, I have consolidated loans, which most students end up doing, although they're monthly payments. But once you consolidate your loans under Sallie Mae, the law doesn't allow you to renegotiate your loan the way someone with anyone with a home mortgage can when the rates go down. So I'm stuck at 8%.
Hmm.
And also, unlike a home mortgage borrower, we student loan borrowers cannot deduct the interest paid over the life of our loans, only for a limited time, whereas the loans extend typically 20 to 30 years. Do these education representatives on your panel support student loan reform. We're not going to get the cost of education down tomorrow, but we can change legislation today to give students relief. And all the students in school now, all the students going to school, more than ever before are worried, oh my God, I can't afford to go to school, even if I can get the aid, because it's all going to be loans.
Well, thank you for calling in. John, first off, can you talk a little bit about grants versus loans? How much of the grants or the loans do students have to pay back? Do we have a percentage?
The typical procedure in a college's student financial aid office will practice what's called packaging. And what's very crucial on that is the sequence. For example, your more affluent colleges probably will try to give a student a grant first, then followed by work study, then followed by loan. But sometimes that gets flipped the other way, where you first receive a loan, and then the remainder, the shrinking remainder, might be subject to get a grant. Now, I'm partial to grants, but what I would like to suggest at the federal level is a policy change. There used to be some prevalent programs, particularly for students who would go into various health fields, in that they would take out pretty substantial loans, but they were then given an opportunity to have those loans forgiven if they served professionally in underserved communities and areas. So something like, for each year that you served, was 20% of your student loan forgiven. And I always thought that was a wonderful compromise where young adults get to practice their profession, gain experience, have a modest income, and get rid of that unwieldy debt. So that, for example, earlier you mentioned the $80,000 debt that was now $180,000. I'd like that $80,000 debt to be zero, and everyone would gain. And I can't think of any member of Congress or governor who really wants to see the next generation of 20 to 25-year-olds going into life saddled with debt. It's just a false sense of economy. So I would like to float the idea of the loan forgiveness for an expanded notion of professional work that is service-oriented. So it wouldn't just be health fields, but it could be teaching, it could be law, pro bono law, any number of range, and that would help our recent college graduates get out from under this yoke of the debt that they acquired in undergraduate and in graduate school.
Just quickly, Elizabeth Warren, Senator Elizabeth Warren, has a plan on the table that would allow individuals with existing loans to refinance at the same lower rates that were set last summer, because last July, Congress allowed interest rates on federal student loans to double. She also wants the federal government to get out of the college loan business. She wants a minimum tax on income over $1 million and allocate $50 billion to refinance student debt. Do you see this going anywhere, John?
Well, the only reason I would be wary of having the federal government get out of the student loan business is that I would tend to have more confidence that federal government would keep those rates affordable and low rather than counting on the private or commercial banking sector. What people forget is that when student loans became part of federal policy, for years, Democrats and Republicans tried in vain to convince the banks to get on board, and it was only after they subsidized the banks heavily that they came on. So, and I know that in 2006, the federal government regained some control and brought some relief to the rising loan rates. So that would be my only caution on that otherwise intriguing tax reform proposal.
We have just a couple of minutes left. And Melanie, as we see the cost of tuition just going up, again, UC system, $13,000 a year, which does not include room and board, $23,000 for out-of-state students. Given the realities that we're facing right now, what does it mean to make higher education affordable? And what would it take to get there?
Well, I mean, I think what does it mean to make higher education affordable? I referred to it a little bit earlier in terms of ideally, in an ideal world, you know, families would be able to bring some savings to the table. The state, I mean, it is a partnership of funding. The state appropriations and state commitment to public higher education in particular would remain steady at a minimum, if not return to previous levels, as well as the colleges and universities' commitment to reining in costs and to find efficiencies wherever possible. And I think then back to some of the earlier conversation, it is about finding the best policies in terms of reasonable financing vehicles. We do have some public service loan forgiveness programs. We're looking at new repayment options or expanded repayment options for loans based on earnings, so that students aren't quite so strapped by their debt. I think that it's a combination of commitments by both families, state, federal governments, and institutions to ensure that we are educating our nation.
And John, 20 seconds, what one change would you like to see to make college accessible to everyone?
I would say recovery of the national economy combined with a new spirit of generosity and compassion toward our young adults. If you don't change the spirit, you're not going to change the structure.
Very nice. John Thielen is a professor of educational policy studies at the University of Kentucky. His most recent book is The Rising Cost of Higher Education. Melanie Corrigan is senior director of higher education and financial aid policy at the College Board. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you. A real pleasure.
Thank you so much. And thanks for all of your phone calls and emails. Thanks for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. Where will the next generation of farmers come from, and will they have land to farm? On the next Your Call, we'll talk about the future of access to land for agriculture in the U.S. and globally. As urban development pushes outward, where will we find the land to feed a growing population? And as farmers retire, what are the solutions at the grassroots level to develop new farming talent and defend cropland? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan, Ali Budner, and Becca Hoekstra produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.